from the great refuge of Atalan, hidden away in the Watcher's blue area of the moon. This is the 8th Longbox Graveyard Podcast. My name is Paul O'Connor, and for the next half hour or so, I will catch you up on what has been going on at my Longbox Graveyard comic book blog, and also bring you this month's feature, which is The Dark Knight Rises. Thank you for listening, whether this is your first time or if you've been with me from the start. And I'm gratified to see that these shows continue to reach an audience. Mo Christensen at We Talk Comics told me an email last week that out of nowhere, my second podcast from last July suddenly exploded. I'm glad no one was hurt, though I'm a little curious what led to this spike. That show was The Ritual, where I looked at why we attend shows like San Diego Comic-Con and express some of my dissatisfaction with that convention. It's certainly nothing especially relevant or groundbreaking at this particular hour, but the show still saw a big surge in downloads. Such are the mysterious ways of the internet. I shall not question them. Instead, I am glad the show is growing, and if you're one of the new listeners brought aboard by that particular episode, maybe you'll write in and tell me how you found the show. Last month's podcast on the Few 52 was also especially satisfying, if a bit long. I received positive feedback through Twitter on that one, so I'll try to get Chris Ulm back on the show in the future and mix in a few of these longer review shows. We're more likely to go at it over old books than new, but it was a fun format, and I'd like to explore it further. The Ulm also dropped the hardback collection of Avengers vs. X-Men on me for Christmas, so maybe we'll review that together. We'll have to see. And speaking of growing audiences, I'm pleased to report that my blog, www.longboxgraveyard.com, is experiencing growth. 5 straight weeks of steady gains since I posted my Longbox Soapbox blog, where I openly questioned whether I should continue with the whole enterprise. But I don't attribute my growing audience to some kind of geeky It's a Wonderful Life moment so much as I do to seasonal factors, topic selection, and most of all, ads. Or their removal, actually. I spiked the crappy Google ads that I was hosting on the site, which had earned me all of $30 in credit over 6 months, and I think they were costing me views because of slower page loads. Ads were an experiment. I never intended to monetize the site, but I like to learn about these things. So anyway, I have no problem letting them go at all. So, readership is up. It's a good time. It's a good time for me. And it's a good time for you to join me at the all-new, all-ad-free Longbox Graveyard sometime soon. And that's as good an excuse as any to look back on what was published at the site since last we spoke. On the 19th of December, I published a blog called Out of the Holocaust, a Hero. And this was a look at Captain Marvel. Not the big red cheese, not the Shazam version, but rather Marvel Comics' rather shoddy knockoff version of Captain Marvel, a character birthed only to assert a copyright claim, or excuse me, a trademark claim, to that name of Captain Marvel. And of course, he's been charitably a secondary character, probably a tertiary character ever since he was born. And he's had his share of pretty rotten comics and a few stellar runs, such as the Jim Starlin run from the 70s. But in this blog, I made a pitch that maybe Captain Marvel is more important than we've given him credit for. That if you take a step back and squint just right and look at his story not as a series of individual issues, but as a mosaic, suddenly there emerges a character that had a beginning, an end, a middle, a meaningful transformation, and a permanent and meaningful death. I think he's actually one of the more significant comic characters of the last century, and he deserves a second look. Well, at least I halfway convinced myself of that when reading the blog, so why don't you go check it out. It was published on the 19th, Out of the Holocaust, a Hero. On the 26th of December, the day after Christmas, I published a review of the Giant Superhero Holiday Grab Bag from 1975, I think it was, by Marvel Comics. The blog was called The Giant Superhero Holiday Grab Bag of Coal, which I'll tip my hand a little bit about how I felt about the book. Which was seasonal fun, to be fair. A series of reprints featuring characters like Nick Fury, the Hulk, Spider-Man, Luke Cage, who does not say Christmas, which I think is a sin. Anyway, it was one of those big oversized holiday editions that Marvel used to publish in the 70s. This was their one of the many Christmas editions they did. Check out the review from the 26th of December at longboxgraver.com. Giant Superhero Holiday Grab Bag of Coal. To bring in the new year, on the 2nd of February, I published the 81st blog that Longbox Graveyard has ever seen. This was Swamp Thing, and it looked at the first four issues of the original Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson run on that character that now has been with us for 40 years. Hard to believe. But I think that points again into what a resilient character this is, and especially what a spectacular character design it was by Bernie Wrightson. Anyway, I heap praise on these first four issues of Swamp Thing. Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson, give it a look. And I'm a guy that loves the Alan Moore version of the character. I even enjoyed somewhat the New 52 version. But the original is really something special. Also on that date, over at StashMyComics.com, I published my Dollar Box column, which was about Swamp Thing number one. So lots of Swamp Thing from Longbox Graveyard at the beginning of the year, both the overview of the first four issues of the Wrightson and Wein run at Longbox Graveyard and over at Stash My Comics, my Dollar Box column, Swamp Thing number one, which is also, I think, one of the great single-issue origin stories in comics. On the 9th of January is the Reader Appreciation Award. This is really just kind of blogging good karma. In November, Flodo, who runs a great Green Lantern page, was kind enough to call me out as one of several blogs that inspire him. And he gave me a Reader Appreciation Award, which is kind of the blogging equivalent of a chain letter. It's really an opportunity just to stop and list some other blogs that you like and to ask and answer some questions. So that's what I do on the 9th. There's also a picture of Thanos there holding a flower, which I think you'll probably dig. So that's on the 9th, the Reader Appreciation Award. Excuse me. And then on the 16th of January, and this may be in the future or the past, depending on when this podcast is posted or when it goes live or where you are, it's spooky math. Don't try to figure it out. But on the 16th, whether it's in your future or in your past, the article at longboxgraveyard.com is Farewell to the King. And this is a affectionate and, frankly, somewhat critical look at Jack Kirby's last ride at Marvel Comics in the mid-70s, specifically his work on his signature character, Captain America. Kirby returned to that book, I think it was for a 25-issue, 28-issue run. Not entirely successful, but it ended on an up note with the origin tale of Arnim Zola with a story that's just off the rails, and I thought was really a lot of fun after all these years. So Farewell to the King publishes on the 16th, looks at the great Jack Kirby's final contribution to Captain America over there at Marvel. So please check out these articles. Join me every Wednesday at www.longboxgraveyard.com when I post a new comic book blog from a world where it's always 1978. You can also find me around the clock on Twitter as @LBoxGraveyard. I'm on Facebook and on Google+. And you can email me directly at longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. Okay. Now on to this month's feature, The Dark Knight Rises. Yes, I'm doing a movie review on the Longbox Graveyard podcast, though not really. I'm not going to review a movie that's 6 months old in any proper fashion. By this point, I expect my entire audience has seen this movie, maybe multiple times. Your minds are made up. You loved it, or you hated it, or you shrugged and moved on. But I do want to share a few thoughts about this film. Maybe not about the film itself so much as what it meant to me and how it fit into this kind of, you know, strange experience of my comic book life this past year. Dark Knight Rises became a thing of dread for me. Now, I like Batman well enough, though I'm far from a Batman fan. And I've written about the character a time or two at the blog, and will probably do more in the future. I can take him or leave him. Batman books aren't especially esteemed in my collection. I have Frank Miller's Dark Knight around here someplace. I have a few graphic novels. And I have the Doug Minch, Gene Colan issues that I reviewed last summer at Longbox Graveyard. But that's it. I'm as likely to enjoy Batman in the old Adam West TV series or Brave and the Bold animation reruns when Cartoon Network can be bothered to air them, as I am to enjoy a Batman comic. I don't read the current Batman books, but that's no indictment, as I don't really read any current comic books. Not on a monthly basis, at least. I did read the first collected volume of Batman Court of Owls from DC's New 52. We'll probably read the rest, but I don't feel any special urgency for it. But these movies, they're a different story. I'm a genuine fan of Christopher Nolan's Bat films. I came to the first of them with very low expectations. I never much liked the Tim Burton films, which I found visually arresting but otherwise strangely inert. I honestly checked out about halfway through the first of them, and I glanced at parts of the others on cable and generally counted them a sad and missed opportunity. Good for a lot of the audience, made a lot of money, but they were a failure with me. When Batman Begins came around, we as an audience hadn't yet been trained to accept reboots, and I resisted the notion of another Batman picture, I must admit. When my wife saw the trailer, she said they should call it Batman Again? And I agreed. I thought the character was played out, and this was just another money grab. Not that there's anything wrong with money grabs, especially in film. I totally get that these movies are about mass audience appeal, and that is fine. But I hate the kind of market-driven, obligation cinema these films so often represent. Mind-numbing Transformers movies, those awful Star Wars prequels, all these toy commercials masquerading as movies, no thank you. But I'm a geek, and I was encouraged by some favorable reviews, so I went to Batman Returns and really enjoyed the movie. It was a fresh take on the character. It was mature and smart and thrilling and fun and dark where Burton's pictures had been shiny. It was my first experience with Christopher Nolan, although I later realized I had previously seen and enjoyed his Memento. I felt it was the first time a superhero picture had really been treated with any kind of intelligence. I enjoyed Sam Raimi's Silver Age love note to Spider-Man, which had come out a couple years before. Those were fun films. And the X-Men pictures had their moments too. But, you know, Batman Begins, I thought, was a watershed. Because it was clearly a superhero movie with people running around in costumes and doing crazy things. And it adhered to the Batman tropes. But it wasn't filmed or structured like a superhero movie, so much as it was like a crime film. And it was an ensemble film with a rich supporting cast and a compelling place to explore in Bruce Wayne's origin and interior life and in the underworld of Gotham City. Plus, ninjas. They make everything better. All of these strengths were also on display in The Dark Knight, the sequel to Batman Returns, and I think a legitimate masterpiece of a movie. I could name maybe 20 pictures I find more worthy than The Dark Knight, but I doubt I could name 50. I think it's a great movie, and in some ways even an important one, and that's with a big I. The crime film beats are even more to the fore in this film. And of course, there is that transcendent performance by Heath Ledger as the Joker. A fearless and bold move from an actor to take on the Joker, while Jack Nicholson's performance was still in living memory. I didn't especially like Nicholson's Joker, but come on. This is Jack Nicholson we're talking about. He's one of the greatest American film actors of all time. Taking on that role added a degree of difficulty that we can't fully appreciate now that the late Mr. Ledger has so thoroughly claimed that role. You can't take your eyes off the man. He's perfect. And knowing that Ledger left us at the height of his stardom still leaves a hole in our world, not unlike the sudden death of Bruce Lee at his moment of Western stardom in Enter the Dragon. So I love this series, and I especially love Dark Knight, which I've seen several times. It was the first Blu-ray I ever bought. And if you're ever in town and visiting the secret headquarters of Longbox Graveyard, it won't take much to talk me into sprawling out on my leather couches in front of my obscenely large television and watching it again. Dark Knight isn't flawless. I don't think the climax with the citizens of Gotham split on the two fairies quite works, though I appreciate the theme it's trying to demonstrate. I think the picture would have been better off leaving the Two-Face portion of Harvey Dent's story for another film, as cramming it into Dark Knight makes for an overly dense third act and a butt-numbing runtime. There's also the casting problem of Maggie Gyllenhaal taking over for Katie Holmes after she was kidnapped by Tom Cruise. But more about that in a minute. And honestly, these are picking nits. I think Dark Knight is a great film. I love this movie. And coming out of it, my expectations for the concluding film in the series, well, they were sky high. They were too high, of course. You know, that Nolan had done two great films was no guarantee he could do a third. It was a lot to expect him to keep this ball rolling. That he brought us the entertaining and thoughtful action film Inception after completing Dark Knight indicated that Nolan still had the mojo. But many are the directors who have wrecked themselves trying to stretch for a trilogy. Francis Ford Coppola couldn't do it. Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 are a pair of the finest films ever made, but let's not speak of Godfather 3. George Lucas came close with his original Star Wars trilogy, but sorry, kids, I think Return of the Jedi runs out of steam when it stops being John Carter, and when those darn teddy bears show up to wreck the Empire, it was an indication of things to come. Spielberg couldn't do it with Indiana Jones, though he at least failed in a novel fashion, cracking up in his second picture with Temple of Doom, and then getting it mostly right with The Sentimental Last Crusade. I dimly remember a fourth picture, too, but I'm trying to forget. Star Trek 2 and 3 are great space operas, but that first movie is a wet fart. Alien 3, Spider-Man 3, X-Men The Last Stand, Terminator 3, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, Day of the Dead. Not all of these are terrible pictures, but none of them are great or original or especially necessary pictures. That third film in a trilogy is treacherous. No. Trilogies are hard. There aren't a lot of great trilogies. You've got Toy Story, and that's about it. Oh, wait, Return of the King, I hear you say. And it got a Best Picture Oscar for Peter Jackson, and I love those movies. But they were shot as one long film. They were going to succeed all as one or fail all as one, and I don't think of them as a trilogy in the sense of these other pictures. You put an asterisk on Jackson's Lord of the Rings. It's not the same as making three films over 10 years with different crews and writers and accelerating budgets and expectation and extra help, air quotes around help, from the studio as the budget blooms. That same asterisk almost applies to the second and third chapters of Back to the Future, which was one of the first of these big blockbusters to be shot all at once. They're films I don't especially like, but I'd put them in the discussion for great trilogies. There are the Bourne pictures. There's Leone's Dollars trilogy. Others I'm sure I'm forgetting, but let's just say that successful three-picture runs are few and far between. So there was a lot riding on Dark Knight Rises, and every reason to expect it would be a failure, or at least a disappointment. And in this, it did not disappoint. Now, I need to unpack it a little, where my mind was when I first saw this picture, and start to get to the point about why I'm sort of reviewing Dark Knight Rises all these months later on a podcast. In the summer of 2012, I was moving into my second year of Longbox Graveyard and feeling more connected to comics than at any time in my adult life. I had structured my blog and even my life around comics. We couldn't afford much of a vacation that year, so these big superhero movie releases were events my family and I really looked forward to. For my pal Chris Holmes' birthday, a big gang of us indulged in the ultimate Marvel movie marathon, where we went to the theater to see all the Marvel Studios movies screened in one sitting, climaxing with the midnight premiere of Avengers. And while my appreciation for Avengers was dented a little by seeing it exhausted and at midnight, it was still a great experience. It's something I shared with my then 12-year-old son, Jack. I blogged about it, too. I'll put a link in the show notes. It was a great day. So it was in part because I was trying to experience that high again that I decided to take in Dark Knight Rises as the midnight capper to another movie marathon, this time of the three Batman films, ratcheting up the stakes and degree of difficulty that much higher for this film. But I was feeling unusually validated in my love of Batman and comics and genre film, and I decided to ignore the warning signs and went in hoping for the best. I recommend film marathons for the story of having done it, for the experience, but they are not quality ways to see a new movie. For movies you know, sure, I think marathons are fine, but a new film deserves a fresh sit, not some crazy multi-hour buildup after which you're already fading before the first reel even starts to turn. And in the case of Batman, this was exacerbated because any film is going to compare unfavorably next to that classic middle installment of Dark Knight. So I couldn't help but be disappointed by Dark Knight Rises, for reasons I will get to in a second, I promise. But if it sounds like I'm making excuses for the film, that's because I am. And that's really what this particular podcast is about, not whether Dark Knight Rises was a good film or not. You can make up your own minds on that. But instead about how these movies come to mean so much to us, how we get so heavily invested in them, how their success or failure can have a lasting impact on our mood and even our self-image and self-worth. Certainly, we've all seen the flame wars of Matrix fans or Star Wars fans fighting over the worth of their sequels and prequels, and maybe you've even fought a few of those yourself. But the only reason we do that is because we are personally so heavily invested in these fictional worlds, invested to a degree well beyond these being mere films anymore. Instead, they become kind of cultural waypoints for us, glamorous symbols that we identify with and that can either be beacons that remind us of what we love, or very public pillories where our foolish fancies are laid bare for everyone to ridicule. And in that department, maybe I'll do a podcast about John Carter someday, if I can stop weeping long enough to do it. I did blog about it. If you're interested, I'll give you a link. Now, I've never been struck by fame. I grew up in Los Angeles. I've been on a couple movie sets. I've run into celebrities. I just don't care. I had a pitch meeting with Steven Spielberg once, which is a pretty good story. I should probably tell it here another time. But any nervousness I felt in that meeting wasn't from being starstruck. It was just from trying not to look like a fool after having had only 72 hours to prepare for a pitch that deserved at least a month. Like I said, it's another story. I'll never understand people who go jelly-legged for stars or run after them in the street, hunt them down for autographs in restaurants, show up to the memorials and weep like they've lost a child. I mean, I kind of understand it, but I don't get it. And I'm more than a little embarrassed by this behavior, sometimes even repelled by it. The whole culture of fame and celebrity, more often than not, inspires loathing in me. I stay away from the gossip rags and the talent shows. If you love those things, God bless you. Keep loving them, but they aren't for me. Reality shows, they make me feel kind of dirty. This whole culture of quick manufactured fame just turns me off. I appreciate art, but I don't feel a need to get inside the artists. And I also feel that the artists themselves deserve their own life, where they can be flawed and fail at things and not always be measured against their own best work, which may not be entirely to their credit in any case. I mean, most actors are just pretty people that speak other people's words. Anyway, it's a tangent. But it's a tangent with a purpose. Because while I'd never run after Christian Bale waving an autograph book, as I was sitting in the theater waiting for those Dark Knight Rises titles to come up, I had an uncomfortable realization that I'd become one of those people. Investing so much of myself in a movie, whether it was good or bad, that it was going to have a direct impact on my mood for days or weeks afterwards. And here it turns out it's actually been months. And in living a public life through my blog, and now this podcast, I felt even more that there was no place to hide. I mean, of course, no one would be looking to me to have an opinion on this thing, but, I felt like they would. That's the inflated self-worth of the blogger. I'd become one of those crazy movie fans who's seen every one of some star's movies and is convinced they have a relationship with a person that doesn't even know they exist. So this panic setting in, and then, roll film! Oh, no! I didn't like the movie much that night. Disappointed me. Now, I've kind of judo-flipped the whole thing in the months that followed. I've forgiven myself for harboring this passion. I've decided it's a good thing that a 50-year-old guy can feel like a teenager about something, and my attachment to these Batman films is a benign addiction. I came away disappointed from Dark Knight Rises, but I bottled it up, and I've carried it around with me, and I've never really told anyone about it before now. So help me get past this. There was the film itself, which I promise I'll get to in due course. But there was also that terrible event beyond the film. That jackass in Colorado, I won't waste breath upon him here, but man, it was a shock. Coming home with my family after our showing, checking the news, seeing there'd been some kind of a disaster in a theater out in Colorado, waking up the next morning and learning how many had been lost, thinking of the misery and terror experienced by those poor souls as they were murdered by this monster. It all felt very intimate. It hit close to home. I'd just been at a midnight show with my wife and my boys, and it just all felt so horrible. For these people who'd had their lives taken away or shattered, they would never be the same again. I couldn't stop thinking about them. I went into a deep funk, and my, by comparison, trivial feelings about the film were bottled up and put away because, after all, what the heck did something like this matter? My feelings about a film, what do they matter in the face of what had happened? After that, I basically tried not to think about Dark Knight Rises for the rest of the summer. I didn't blog about it, didn't really talk about it. I did feel vaguely depressed about it and angry with myself for letting a movie affect me that way. I never really came to grips with what was troubling me about this movie, this crazy mix of overcommitment, under-delivery, and sense of inflated importance. Like I said, it was bottled up until this week when I saw the picture on Blu-ray. Santa Claus brought us a copy and checked it out. Now, knowing the film's faults ahead of time, I was better able to accommodate them this time through. The first time through, I got hung up on things and couldn't let go of them. Now I know where the potholes are in the road. I can steer around them well ahead of time instead of blowing up my suspension by nosing into these ditches. And, you know, I suppose it's time to list these faults. There are many for Dark Knight Rises. I'm sure you have a list of your own. I doubt anyone regards this picture as flawless or a masterpiece. Anyway, here are mine. I will restrict myself, this isn't all of them, but I'll restrict myself to the problems for which I have an answer. In the finest Monday morning quarterback fashion, I'm going to tell Christopher Nolan, this immensely talented and gigantically wealthy filmmaker, what he did wrong. Get ready, Chris. I'm going to bring you to your knees with the Long Box Graveyard podcast. So, the first problem, the mask. Okay. Tom Hardy's a terrific actor. He's charismatic. He's handsome. Commands the screen. But, you know, actors are their faces. And asking Tom Hardy to act out this role through that contraption on his face, I think, was a fatal mistake. I mean, Marlon Brando would have a hard time acting through that thing. If you remember the Sam Raimi Spider-Man pictures, I think there's an interview where Raimi said he made such a terrible mistake that he had, of course, a Spider-Man character that has to wear a full face mask going up against an immobile Green Goblin mask half the time. I mean, by the third act, he's finding every contrivance to tear those masks or smash them in some fashion. This is something he continues in further films. If you go back and look at Avengers, I think you'd be surprised how few masks there really are in it. Captain America throws his mask back whenever he can. When Tony Stark's in his armor, we get a lot of shots of his heads-up display. I mean, actors are face dancers. That's what Frank Herbert called them. And you gotta let us see their faces. That's what they do. That's their moneymaker. And by encumbering Tom Hardy with this mask, I think it really damages the character and damages his ability to act this role. And it's especially problematic in that critical first scene in the plane, because the poor devil is on his knees with his hands bound behind him. So he can't even move around and exert any of the physicality that he uses elsewhere in the film. All he can do is just kind of swing his head back and forth. So I don't know why they went with that crazy mask. Maybe it was hubris. Maybe it was, you know, Christopher Nolan had done two of the greatest superhero films of all time. No one could tell him anything. I don't know. Solution simple, as far as I'm concerned. You can still have a mask. Just don't cover his nose and mouth with it. You know, have these horrible tubes that dig into his cheeks and look real painful, and he's wheezing all the time. And you accomplish the same function, and you've got that character's face. My God, so I can see the actor. So, that's a problem. Because every time Bane comes on screen with that looped-in voice and that terrible mask, it, you know, you notice it. And you shouldn't be noticing things like that. It throws you out of the picture. A second big problem for me was Batman in a bathrobe. You know, the film starts off with Batman moping around the house, bitter over losing Maggie Gyllenhaal, Well, I know this woman's supposed to be his childhood sweetheart and the only genuine woman he ever loved and et cetera, but come on. This is Bruce Wayne. It's been 8 years. He can have his pick of any woman in the world. Even if Maggie was one in a billion, there's five other women out there like her on Earth, and I bet Bruce could find him. So, I really didn't buy him being heartbroken. I understand the character needs to start on this down note so that he can rise over the course of the film, but how much more interesting might it have been if we reversed the roles of Batman and Alfred? What if Batman has shut himself away from Gotham for 8 years, not because he's moping over losing his girlfriend, but because he's furious with the people of Gotham City? What if Batman has turned his back on Gotham? What if Batman has decided that he gave his health, he gave his soul, he damn near gave his life to the people of Gotham, and they threw it all away? They regard him as a murderer, and they've gone right back to their savage murdering ways the moment he stopped patrolling the city. Maybe they're not worthy of him anymore. And then maybe Alfred is saying, hey, this isn't the Bruce Wayne that I know. This isn't the kid that I raised. What's wrong with you? And they can have their conflict over something meaningful. To me, that first act, and Wayne especially, would be a lot more interesting if he's resentful and suffering from a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. Make him messed up instead of just moping around. And then, you know what? He's got an arc. He's got some place to grow. He rises not from his own self-pity, but he instead makes a heroic return from bitterness and into the light. And then at the end of the picture, when he sacrifices himself anyway for a city that turned on him, now that would be a heroic send-off for the series. Finally, there's that pit. Off in Turkey or someplace or whatever. Batman gets his back broken. Spoilers, I guess. Sorry if you've gotten this far and you haven't seen the movie. So Batman gets his back broken and he's tossed into this pit. And I'm sorry, it just brings the film to a halt. We keep cutting back and forth to Bruce doing push-ups and looking at the sunlight, and he's surrounded by all these characters we don't really know. I mean, it's a nice vehicle to learn of Bane's origin, but it's remote and it's awkward. Now, I think that it serves an important function because it shows Batman overcoming problem and externalizing his growth. You know, he's coming back into the light. That's fine. My solution is make this more personal. You know, Bane has built this secret empire in the sewers beneath Gotham. What if he's built a reproduction of the prison where he was born? And this is specifically a place he's built because he's going to toss Batman down there after he breaks him. And then what if we populate that prison with all those Gotham cops that are trapped underground and sit around for however long it is? You know, just waiting for some plot contrivance to let them out of the underground again. So if we got a broken Batman down there in that pit, and we have all of Gotham's cops down there, and you have a saintly Commissioner Gordon that maybe has lost some of his sway over his men, who's being overruled by a self-interested Matthew Modine, who represents the worst of Gotham's police, fighting back and forth, and Batman, who fixes his back and rises from that pit on his own grit, and then leads Gotham's police out of the pit as well, leads a counterattack on Bane, who can't believe that not only is Batman back, but he's brought all these police with him. Well, you know, it's a little awkward, I suppose, but it's no more awkward than what's in the picture, and it also has the additional value, if you don't have to explain how Batman got from that hole to Gotham City as fast as he did, and I guess, what, walked across the ice? So again, I mean, at the center of it, it focuses on our hero doing things and characters that are more meaningful to us, and a transformation that makes more sense. That's what I would have done, at least. Anyway, I mean, there's a host of lesser problems, of course, including an action-packed third act that sadly cannot compete with Avengers on the city destruction scale. You can't really hold that against the picture. I mean, a third act of Avengers is an amazing action experience. It's like a Transformers movie where you actually care about the characters, and I mean that as high praise. You know, there's also plenty right with Dark Knight Rises. There's good performances, great actors. I loved Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the cop who might be Robin. I thought Anne Hathaway was very good as Catwoman. I mean, she owns the screen in that scene where she goes from Catwoman to shrieking girl in a bar to cold casual Catwoman again in a matter of seconds. She's just great. I like the supporting cast in Gary Oldman and Morgan Freeman and Michael Caine, though for the most part they are underused. I even came around to like Tom Hardy's Bane once I forgave his many flaws. He has a little arc of his own. I came to like him by the end. I would have preferred for him to go out at the end of the picture some way other than being shot by Han Solo coming back in the Millennium Falcon, or whatever it was. And, I mean, this resolution was a lot less satisfying than Han shooting Darth Vader at the end of Star Wars, because that scene at least represents Han's redemption. Whereas in this picture, it felt more like a clock ticking. It was just time for Catwoman to come back, and I don't know, didn't feel like a redemption moment for her. But you know what? Now I'm going down the rabbit hole, criticizing again that film is, you know, the film's not that bad, really. Rewatching the movie nudged it from a C to a C+, B- maybe for me. It's the least of the trilogy, but it's not a war crime, and I'm at peace with it. I look forward to seeing it again in a year or two. It tried for big things and came up short, and we should admire a film that does that rather than criticize it. So I saw it. I exercised my demons. I'm able to articulate my criticism to you. Thank you for listening, but I'm still disappointed. Why? I'm disappointed because it's over. There's no more Batman. There are reboot plans, I expect. We're supposed to get a Justice League of America picture in 2015 that'll have Batman in it in some fashion or another. But it will never be the same as this. It'll never be this special again. It'll be different. Might be better. But it won't be this thing again. It won't be as anticipated as it was. It won't make me feel I was part of something so mainstream again. Sure, there are geek popcorn movies coming out, but none with this, you know, this level of importance, I think. It feels like a wasted opportunity, but mostly, I'm sorry that I don't have another Christopher Nolan Batman picture to look forward to, even if that picture must end up disappointing me. And in this, I finally get to the point of this Long Box Graveyard podcast. In this, I have a window into how many in my audience may feel, and the way I used to feel about comic books. Before I gave up on reading monthly books to dwell safely in the year of 1978, I used to be pretty invested in the adventures of my heroes. Not so invested that I'd send death threats to Dan Slott or whatever, but I'd look forward to the next book in the month, and while I'm still not completely comfortable with the fan that chases craters down the street, this does remind me a bit of this passion I used to feel for comics, and it gives me a bit more sympathy for fans held hostage by Peter Parker's brain-swapping fate, or the sweeping changes made to DC's comic universe last year, or, I don't know, Star Trek television fans who feel abandoned by the new direction of the J.J. Abrams film, which I love, by the way. You know, in holding myself above the fray and only putting a toe in the pool, I thought I might protect myself from these passionate geek disappointments. Plus, I had the satisfaction of watching my poor fellow geeks tie themselves into knots, trying to explain how, if you looked at it just the right way, the Star Wars prequels weren't that bad. I mean, what a bunch of suckers. But, you know, in stripping away all my reasons to be melancholy over Dark Knight Rises, I find I'm not so far above it as I thought, that I'm more deeply invested than I had ever guessed. And while it may not come as a surprise to you, who knows that I am a fan because of this blog and podcast, it's still a startling bit of self-realization for me. And you know what? It's also really welcome. Because if I can be hurt by these silly things, then that means there must be some joy here too. And I'm going to concentrate on finding that joy. I'm going to climb out of my well, just like Bruce Wayne in Dark Knight Rises. And you know, maybe there's some enlightenment to be had too. In getting out of that well, maybe I can bring some wisdom back, or at least some insight. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell tells us that the most difficult task of the hero is not accepting adventure in the first place or enduring the road of trials. It's the heroic return. It's the ability to come back into the community and reintegrate yourself with knowledge that makes not only your life better, but everyone else's life better. So, you know, what have I learned about being so attached to something that doesn't know I exist? I think this is an important question for fans to consider. And I'm not sure I have an answer, but I have some ideas. I think a big part of it is that in, you know, fill in the blank, whatever it is you're passionate about, comics, games, movies, in our attachment to these things, I think we see an opportunity for perfection. Certainly our lives aren't perfect. We all have problems. Some of us have, you know, bigger issues to deal with than others, but none of us are perfectly content, I think, in our lives, our marriages, our jobs, our schoolwork, whatever it is that's in front of us. We always find some kind of defect. And, you know, these vanished pursuits are escapism in the purest form. And it's not just an investment of our interest in these things that make it this way. It really is a desire to participate in something that can be perfect or close to perfect, that's outside of us, that can remain perfect, that can maybe remain ageless as we age. That in the case of the best art, that we'll come to appreciate in different ways as we age, but remains a perfect whole thing. So when we do discover something that we love so much, as I did, for instance, The Dark Knight, or, you know, non-genre films like Goodfellas, or, 2001, Space Odyssey, certainly a genre film. These things that we cling to and say, these are the masterpieces that are going to get me through my life. They're perfect things. Not without flaws, but they're perfect things compared to our lives. So, when we become invested in them, and we either revisit them later in life and they don't live up to our expectations or our memories, as often happens with the comics I read here at Longbox Graveyard, but also when a future installment of something that we so love disappoints us, it's out of all proportion to what the thing actually is. Yeah, it's just a movie, but it's more than that, because to us at least, it represents an opportunity to go someplace and experience something that's not going to occur in our regular lives. I mean, regular lives are great. Believe me, you know, I love being with my kids, my wife. These vanished pursuits, they're important too. So I'm coming to grips with that. And, that particular journey is still ahead of me. It's one I hope you will share with me here on this podcast and at my Longbox Graveyard blog, as I gradually come to understand, as I noted in a previous broadcast, that you have to grow old, but you don't have to grow up. So we're just about done for the month. Here's where to find me. I already said this, but, you know, I sure love to hear from you guys. So please write to me. You can reach me at LBoxGraveyard on Twitter. You can also reach me by writing to longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. Those are the surest ways to find me. You can also dig me up on Facebook, Google+, however you got to do it. Send up a smoke signal. Send me a message. Tell me what you think of the podcast. Tell me if you think I'm full of it. Love to hear from you. All right, so plug of the month, and we'll get out of here. This month's plug is for the Book Guys Show podcast. This is co-hosted by my Twitter pal and a frequent Longbox Graveyard commenter, Professor Allen. He's their comic book guy. It's a far-ranging podcast. I was very impressed. They cover book news, book reviews, comic books, of course, audiobooks, books on TV, movies. It's really quite far-ranging, well-produced, intelligent hosts, interesting opinions, and they've got jingles. I mean, jingles. I'm jealous. I need jingles here on Longbox Graveyard, so we'll have to see if we can catch up in the jingle department. In the meantime, find them on iTunes, the Book Guys Show podcast. There's 60 podcasts in. They're really good. I recommend them. I'm learning a lot from listening to their podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes. The Book Guys Podcast. This one's for you, Professor Allen. This is for you, my audience. Thanks to you for listening and for supporting my many endeavors, both here at the podcast and at www.longboxgraveyard.com, where there's a new blog every Wednesday night. Thanks also to Mo Christensen, as always, and the guys at We Talk Comics for publishing and promoting this podcast. That'll do it for this month. So this is Paul O'Connor for the Long Box Graveyard Podcast. Until next time, I will see you in the funny papers.